listener production.
Shares. Market. The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is back in our parents' bedrooms. No, not really, but we are not live this week, at least not live in front of a studio audience. That was last week. And Andrew Page from strawman.com, that was a whole lot of fun.
Oh, it's so much fun. Yeah.
Did we have a good time?
Yeah. It's a little bit nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it was a bit.
It's easy
to kind of look at each other over Zoom and make outrageous statements and comments. When you got to do it and look at people looking back at you, it's a bit of performance anxiety that creeps in.
There definitely is. And I think I said to you afterwards, what's hard is that for a lot of people, their concentration face is the same as their annoyed face. And so you'd look out and it's just like, am I making you think or am I annoying you? And
Are you just waiting for this to finish so you can leave, or are you actually enjoying
right?
it?
Yeah. But it was so much fun. It was so great to meet so many of the listeners and just talk shop with a bunch of investors. So yeah, really enjoyed it.
It was fun.
If you made it, thanks for coming. It was really, really so worth it too. And a great little venue as well. Nice little craft brewery.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, really good. But I just missed out on the pizza. Nice. I didn't get any pizza, unfortunately. So,
a quick behind the scenes for our listeners. You and I did actually do a servo run at, what was it, 10 or 10:30 at night. And as you said, I've done this
since
I was whatever age. I was like, yeah, me either. We literally went to the local Shell at the hotel and got a sausage roll each, which is, that was our dinner that night.
Well, we are value-oriented investors. So, we're not going out to a fancy restaurant, let's be honest.
Can I say, too, the quality of servo food has improved meaningfully. Not fantastically, but what you would have got from a servo. Well, what we did get when we were a certain age back a couple of decades ago, mate. I don't know. Maybe it's rose-colored glasses, or maybe it's the reverse. Because I reckon you could do okay. It was a 4-20 sausage roll with some sauce. Yeah. It was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't want to think about it too much. I don't know how long that sausage roll had been sitting there before I came along.
There is that.
I remember back in the uni days, it was very common for me to grab a hero roll on the way home.
You mentioned that. I don't recall hero rolls.
An affront to nature.
and cuisine.
It was like chicken gravy bread roll, but sort of vacuum sealed in this pack that would sit there. And you'd heat it in the microwave so the bread would come out or something.
You know what?
Look.
Go on.
I was going to say, a few beers in at the end of the night, it's like it was food, right? So you'd take it. But
I just had a flashback to a Caltex servo near my high school. And it was one of those ones where they had, it was a hot dog in one of those alfoily kind of roll things. And it sounds like something similar. We used to go there. It was like $1 or $2 because I'm 85 years old and things were cheap then. And we'd all jump in the car at lunchtime at school because we were allowed to duck out at lunch and come back again. And we'd go and get one of those dodgy $1 or $2 hot dogs, whatever they were. That was there's a flashback for you. Wow.
Oh, it's just I feel sick just thinking about it.
Hey, mate. You know how I never ever give us a wrap on this podcast whenever our listeners write in. I'm going to continue not to do that. But I am going to mention. I'm going to read something we got from Jordan because firstly, I'll echo your thoughts, mate. Thank you to everyone who did turn up. I know, by the way, it was on the Gold Coast. If you live somewhere else, you probably couldn't turn up. But a heap of people came down from Brisbane, which I really appreciated. Including one couple I met who came down by public transport from Brisbane and then were going back at like 9:30 at night. That's serious commitment. Well, so thank you, guys.
Can we apologize in advance because Erin, God love her, who works there at the Fool, helped sort of set it up. She's like, guys, it's a live event, all right? 45 minutes tops each episode. People have to get home. It's like, yep, got it. And we just, I don't know how long we went for an hour and a half.
She knows better than that. Yeah. But yes, thank you for those.
But I do apologize for people who did. We were planning on probably leaving at a much earlier time.
How long can this possibly go? Now, yes, I agree with you, except that if Aaron didn't know any better, our listeners definitely knew better because they know our predilection for
it's on you. Talking. It's your fault. Correct. You knew what you were getting yourself into.
But Jordan wrote us an email and said, "Hello, Scott and Rampage. I'm writing to let you both know that myself and my partner were attendees of the live podcast on the Gold Coast recently. I just wanted to say thanks for making this happen and the effort you both put in week out. Now, this is, by the way, we like compliments, but this is actually why I'm mentioning this. And again, it's self-serving entirely, but also hopefully helping other people too. Jordan says, it was an awesome night and my partner, who doesn't listen to the show, came away from it motivated and glad that she went. On the way home, I've never had her ask so many questions about investing and stock picking. We're in our mid to late 20s, bastards, and are long-term investors who put as much as we can into the market every month. And your thoughtful answer to one of my questions on the night helped reinforce that what we're doing is a good thing for us and our future. You both provide logical and easy to understand discussions about money and investing that are accessible to the everyday person, my partner included. Thanks and keep up the good work, Jordan and Marika. So guys, thank you for coming. Thanks, Jordan, for the message. Very, very kind of you, mate. It's, Andrew and I've got egos, obviously, but we kind of do this because we're trying to help. I mean, as we've said before, we'd probably do it anyway, right? Ram and I just sit and chat and, you know, forget to press the record button and it'll be fine. We'll be 85 and, you know, doddering into our pretend podcast microphones in our nursing homes. But we also, like, you know, why do we do it? What's the value other than just catharsis and to save our wives? It's just because we kind of genuinely do like to try and help people. So if we have helped Jordan and Marika and hopefully some other people who listened and who turned up, then that's really cool.
You just painted such an accurate vision of the future. I'm reminded of there's a few nursing homes around and they have fake bus stops out the front.
Oh,
so
right.
If a resident escapes, you know, I shouldn't laugh because it's a serious thing. But there were issues. There have and often are issues with residents sort of leaving, getting on a bus, and you know everyone freaking out. So they put these fake bus stops where a bus just never came, and then you know you'd go out and you'd find the residents. When it's our turn, they're just going to put a podcast mic in the common room, but it won't be like the cord will just go behind the desk. Be no one there. If you and I are just chatting away, it's like, no, come on, Mr. Phillips, time for your medicine. But my listeners, I need to. I've got some comments. Like, sure you do.
Link a letter to this later. Oh, okay then. Okay, we'll have the minutes. Then we'll get back to it. Yeah, good idea. Yeah. I also somewhere between that and Waldorf and Statler from the Muppet Show. Yeah. For those old enough to remember those guys, is kind of what the vision I have in my head. So you're probably right. Anyway. So yeah, thank you for listening. Thank you for those who turned up. Hopefully we'll get to do another one at somewhere else at some point. So we'll see how that pans out. But certainly we had a ball. Hopefully our listeners enjoyed it, and if more people want to come along to somewhere else, then I don't know, Ram and I aren't that hard to get convinced to turn up and talk into a microphone, so we'll see how we go.
Yeah, nice.
Mate, let's get to the week, the news of the week. I'm going to start with a bit of a macro, but a bit of an unusual macro, mate, because this one is one that kind of is weird from a theoretical perspective. When you think about what the general orthodoxy is on investing, we're not going to talk about central banks unless Ram takes us there, which he may well.
No.
The gold is nearing an all-time record. And normally gold is kind of the hedge against stuff, hedge against inflation, hedge against market volatility, hedge against whatever else. The thing is, at the same time gold is on the rise, stocks both in the US and Australia are also at or very near all-time highs. And that's kind of a thing. It's not something that's supposed to happen. When, you know, when things are good, gold's supposed to suffer because it doesn't produce anything. There's no income. There's no, you don't need the hedge because things are going well. Or even if you do need the hedge, maybe it's a kind of cyclical thing. Not enough people do it. So you generally tend to find, again, this is not perfect and it's not all the time. And don't at me about history. Just the general orthodoxy is stocks up, gold down. Or gold up, stocks down, broadly speaking. Well, I was going to make a statement. I phrase the question. Is it remarkable that both of these things are on the rise at the same time? For those investors who would say, well, I have some gold in my portfolio for XYZ reason, at the moment, they're probably trying to have their cake and eat it too, saying, I have it for volatility protection, but I also have it because it's going up. So which one of those is it? What's going on, mate? What do you make of it? Is there a lesson, a warning? Is there a message? What is the market telling us? What can we tell about the market based on what's going on with those two asset classes?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, some of the things I've read, that people are trying to make sense of it. And it is our want to, I mean, I've said it before and I forget the attribution, but, you know, humans are sort of pattern-seeking, storytelling animals.
Yeah.
And it's so accurate. It's exactly what we are. And so we've seen a pattern and now we're wrapping narratives around it. And really just has to sound good a lot of the time too, because the truth is no one knows. The honest answer is that those with capital to deploy are choosing to invest in both of those assets at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, why? I don't know, but they are. Clearly they are. Yeah. The one that resonates with me, and again, we don't really know what the truth is here. And it will be multifactorial as well. Be some people doing it for one reason, others doing it for another. But I feel it's a consequence of the US fiscal situation. I keep coming back to that. So gold is a funny thing. It's kind of only a thing because it has, you know, 5,000 years of historical precedent. Like that's the only reason as to why it. I think you can take all of the gold ever mined and all of the gold reserves that are known about or accessible, and it'll fill like 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Yes.
So there's, and of those 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools, there's a tiny bit used in sort of chips, some in dentistry. There's a big chunk used in jewelry, and then the majority of it just sits polished in bars in a vault somewhere. Like it is a pure monetary premium that's sort of on that.
Just quickly,
and it kind of works because
so just years ago, Buffett said, "quote I will say this about gold: if you took all the gold in the world, it would make a cube roughly 67 feet on each side."
Oh, there you go. Yeah, it's just surprising, right?
Because right.
Surely there's more than that.
So it's 67 feet. It's 20 meters, which is not small. But think about the entire, like you got every bit of gold from everywhere, right around the world. You put it at one spot, melt it down, and make a cube out of it. 20 by 20 by 20. I mean, it's big, but that's it. It's not
that big. Well, you can only make it in a supernova, right? So it's, anyway, so it has this historical precedent. And then really in modern times, if you want to go back 50-ish years, sort of around the 60s, 70s, that store of wealth kind of got replaced by US treasuries. That became
the default
standard, the risk-free asset, as it's called. So again, we go back far enough and the whole economy was on a gold standard, and then the US currency, all currencies were backed by gold, and then the US currency was backed by gold, and then other international currencies were pegged to that. And then in the 70s, Nixon said, nah, stuff it, we're just going, we don't even need to peg it anymore. And so what we really had were these sort of promises from the US government that will make you whole. And we're very strong, we're very powerful, we're very rich, we're very resourceful.
Can I say just quietly as you say that? I can hear that in Donald Trump's voice. We're very powerful, we're very rich. I can't do the accent, but it feels very Trumpy and that kind of, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
We're very powerful, very rich. I'm very stable genius. Go on. Sorry.
I know this is a long arc, but I feel as though it's the one that makes sense to me. And then, as we've discussed before, I don't think this is anything imminent on this, but the trajectory is concerning. I mean, the US is adding $1 trillion in debt every 100 days, right? And there's no way that they can pay it all back. So what's one of the interesting data points here is that, I'm not to make it about central banks, but global central banks around the world, the RBA has gold. When I say has gold, it's like, I think it's held in the UK somewhere. And
or
like
the US or both. It's weird. Yeah.
It's not here. Don't go to Martin Place looking for a big vault of gold. So it's kind of weird. But anyway, they've got some, all central banks have some, because again, it's just this thing that we all sort of recognize. When you look at the aggregate holding, and they have a lot of US treasuries, right, as well, because that's the global reserve asset. The proportion of that from central banks has been shifting, and it's certainly been shifting from places like China and Russia and people that are, you know, a bit of an axe to grind against the US. And why wouldn't you? Now, if you were Russia, right, you had all this money and all of a sudden someone just said, no, we're not going to let you have, we're not going to honor this for you anymore. And so if you've got any potential concerns with your relationship with Uncle Sam, you may want to diversify. In fact, that's been happening. And so a lot of other countries thought the counterparty risk here has never been recognized as anything worth worrying about because it's the US and everyone accepts it. And why would they do that? And that the USD has been somewhat weaponized from a geopolitical stance. So you're seeing this geopolitical shift back to the only other thing that people are sort of recognizing has value. So I think you've got that kind of demand there, and you've got this demand from markets where, again, it's just like, well, if you can't pay back your debt and you can't even barely service your interest repayments, and you're going to be making people whole nominally by essentially printing up more money and, like, you know, the Fed itself buying the debt from Uncle Sam, I am concerned of inflation, and it's an inflation hedge. And in fact, I would broaden it out to anything you might consider hard assets like property or the S&P 500 index. That why are they all moving in concert? Because there is a, I think there is a gradual but noticeable skepticism in the US dollar. That's a very big call. And it's, again, I'm not saying anything's going to happen soon, but the trajectory is just, like as I say to you all the time, it's just maths. Right? It's just maths. They can't do it. And so like, okay, there's going to be a massive hike on tax, a massive cut to spending, an insane productivity boost, the likes of which history has ever seen, or we're just going to print more money. And I think much of the world has come to that recognition. And it's just sort of like, we want to lessen our exposure. So that's the narrative that I've naturally gravitated towards, but yeah, right. I'm keen to hear your take.
Well, before I do, I am curious though, for all of that, can the gold bugs and the equity investors be right at the same time on that content? I mean, if that is the case for gold, which is some sort of hedge against that kind of money printing driven inflation.
Mm. It's wealth preservation. Sorry to interrupt. No. It's not so much the return that I think people are looking at per se, but it's the wealth preservation. And it's like if I can more or less in broad terms maintain purchasing power with this, that's all I want to do.
And though in that context, though, would it make sense for both gold and shares to be up in your view? I mean, this is the bit that's fascinating. There are arguments for either or, and generally speaking, I say you normally see one fall while the other rises. What's unusual this time around is both high and very high, frankly, at or near records at the same time. That's the bit that's weird, because ordinarily you'd say, okay, well, what's happened is people are selling stocks and they're buying gold because X, right? And if your argument or your theory is right, then it would be sensible to do that. If you're wrong or people don't agree with you, even if you are right, they don't agree, they say, well, I don't agree with Andrew, I'm going to buy shares because I'm not worried about, the gold and shares high at the same time. That's the bit that I find most fascinating. Normally there's, one of the most ridiculous overused cliches is rotation, right? The idea of people rotate from one asset class to another or one sector to another. It's all used in hindsight as if it's somehow some sort of collective decision to all do this at the same time. But again, the idea of both being high at the same time. Well, actually, I'll give you my thought actually, and then you can jump back in. My suspicion is that actually is not miles away from your kind of comments, which is we've seen a lot of asset price inflation. Inflation makes it sound like there's no justification for it. So I want to be a little bit careful with my language. We've seen asset price growth over the last few years. You know, when COVID hit and house prices went up 25% in Australia, the share market has hit all-time highs after that. Gold is near all-time highs. The idea of, a certain amount of money chasing a certain number of assets kind of feels about right. Now, with companies, it's easier sometimes. It's even easier with property, frankly, although we don't necessarily agree that they should be that expensive. But you can look at a valuation and say, well, okay, well, yeah, is there or is there not an increase in PEs or a decrease in rental yields, which suggests there's more money chasing the assets with no reasonable improvement or increase in the output? So that is just
Can I just double down on what you said there, because that's the key point. So there's a difference if equities or properties are rising because the underlying fundamental cash flows are justifying that.
Yes.
So that your property's doubled in value, but your rental income has as well. So it's still a wash. When you've got price rises more explained by what they call multiple expansions. Just like, the company's earned a little bit more, but what we pay per dollar of earnings has gone up.
Yes, exactly.
Or the rent may have increased on your investment property, but the yield has still fallen. Like there are these kinds of phenomena, which to me, it feels as though it is, there is a store of value premium in these assets beyond the pure analytical cash flow analysis sort of angle with these assets.
There is no alternative is almost kind of... Again, though, so the difference for me, though, and I guess what I was talking about, the valuations, you can't do that with gold. So there's no objective way to say gold should be worth more or less, or it's increased or decreased relative to some sort of income or profit generating capacity. So you kind of can't do it with gold. Yep. But the fact that both can be up at the same time suggests that there is simply more cash chasing the assets in total. And my best guess, mate, is that they're both up just because there is so much money around. And on a relative basis or even an absolute basis, investors are looking at both, not having to sell shares to buy gold or sell gold to buy shares. They've got the money to buy both. And to some degree, that must be the case because a dollar can only be spent once, or in this case, invested once. You can buy shares or gold if you want to buy both, you have to have $2. You know, I mean, you can have 50 cents each, but you get my idea. So for both to be up at the same time suggests a whole lot of money chasing assets that otherwise would have to be a choice between the two. And I could be entirely wrong, but it just seems most logical, speaking of it's just maths, if you kind of think it through, either there's a reduction in supply, and there seems no reduction in gold supply, nor reduction in the supply of rental properties or you know, businesses to invest in. Mm-hmm. There's fewer companies for what it's worth, so maybe there's a tiny bit of that, but that's been a long, long, long-term reality of the number of investable companies on public markets has been falling. So maybe it's that. Maybe money's come out of, I don't know, NFTs we talked about, you know, non-fungible tokens, the old ape pictures. Maybe it's come out of, I don't know, some other speculative asset or something else, or out of cash, because people just went, hey, I used to have cash, now I feel like I can invest. So there's a rush. I'm not even saying anything's overvalued as a result. It just strikes me that there is no alternative other than, given the available supply of investable assets, if they're all up or most of them are up, again, Australian housing's up, gold's up, shares are up, it strikes me it must just be a case. And it could have just gone to one asset or the other. So it is notable that it's gone to all of them, because we're seeing those highs. But yeah, it just strikes me it's just a fundamental chasing of assets because they've got money to invest.
It's a relative game, right? Yeah. So there are just more dollars around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, every year, the supply of gold above ground grows by about 2%, I believe, something in that order, because people are always mining new stuff and adding it to the existing supply. So you've got money growth. I'm reluctant to get too much into the weeds here, but Google M2 money supply, because money's weird, right? As you know, so basically commercial banks largely create money when they lend you money. So I got a loan recently.
Mm-hmm.
Now the bank just credited the vendor's bank account with that money. Just poof. It exists. And that was balanced on their balance sheet by a promise, pinky promise from me, yours truly, to say, I will pay that back over the next 30 years.
Yep.
And all of that money now is in the system. It's not a nefarious thing. It's just fractional reserve banking. It's just how it works.
So it's done, yeah.
And so I'm not, but it's just, I always mention it because I think if you're unfamiliar with this stuff, it really kind of blows your mind. It
takes a while to get around. Like, yeah.
Because I think if you went into the street and you interviewed 100 people and said, where's all the money? It's like, there's a vault there, or there's a ledger, you know, with the RBA that says how much there's, like, no, it's just, it is whatever they say it is. And it's fine because it's a trust-based system.
Yeah.
But this stuff is measured. You can measure M2 and, it's, you know, I pulled it up here, in fact, for the US. So at the moment, in January 2024, we have $20 quadrillion in US dollars, right? I think I'm reading that right.
Right.
That sounds right. Maybe it's trillion. That's a lot of zeros.
Either way. Yeah.
Well, it was at the start of the century, it was a fifth of that, right?
Yeah.
And what you see, this general increase. And then what happened in 2020? Well, we had COVID and we had a whole bunch of extra money poofed into existence. And then it just sort of went vertical there for a while. And we're still, again, we are, history is just one damn thing after another, is one of my favorite quotes. And we are dealing with, it's long been my position. I think it's obvious when you look at it, is just that we have a lot more dollars in circulation. Not, again, for evil reasons necessarily. It's just, you know, in the way that the chips landed, and there's not extra gold. There's not extra Apple stock. There's not extra Nvidia stock. There's not extra CSL stock. There's not extra two-bedroom units in downtown Melbourne. You know, there are, my original point is that it's a relative game. It's a relative game. And so you've seen the unit of account in which we sort of measure everything has rapidly, significantly expanded at a well above historical rates. Yes, I know people will point out they've been tapering a little bit. It has, but it's still so far up there. And it's like inflation. It kind of never goes down. It might dip occasionally, but it's sort of generally up and to the right.
Yep.
And I think that's explained. It feels, I think it's unsatisfying to a lot of people in the industry because it is too easy. Yeah. It's like, it can't be that easy. But to me, I'm not a smart man, so I gravitate towards the simplistic. And I feel as though I can come up with these very, very advanced theories, mm-hmm. or I can just say there's a lot more money, there's not much more hard assets, the only thing to balance the equation is a rise in price.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that's kind of where we're at. I think that's worth. It's worth thinking about. Interestingly enough, mate, I saw a graph the other day. I don't want to get central banks at all, really, because we do this relatively regularly.
We do it too much, yeah. Yep.
No, not too much. Just, you know, we've done enough. The RBA, and you will be close to this because you're more fascinated by this than I am. But I think what I saw was a graph talking about the fact there is actually quantitative tightening now in Australia because those extra funds that were made available by the RBA that actually got redeemed because they were limited term bonds aren't being replaced with new bonds.
And so they're letting them roll off, as they say.
Yeah, so we're actually having that, which, to extend your analogy, strikes me as very, very, very smart to kind of get back in some way, again, as usual, the RBA, the adults in the room, notwithstanding whether the RBA should exist, as you said before, but relative to government, they are the adults in the room saying, well, if you guys don't do anything, we're going to have to do the important, serious, responsible stuff. And to whatever extent they did pump liquidity, is a horrible, horrible cliche and jargon, but to whatever extent they did put extra money into the system, they are taking that back out. And again, not actively, but just letting those things, as you say, roll off. In other words, the bonds are redeemed and not reissued. Apparently, that is starting to reduce that boost that was put in place during the COVID period, which again, seems to me entirely appropriate. If you are going to have a structure like that, if you are going to, you know, add temporary liquidity, you want to take that away when it's not needed to get things back towards normal, not too normal, towards normal. So I guess I'm a little more hopeful about the sensible positioning of the Australian economy and regulatory bodies and fiscal realities, even though I'm deeply unhappy with the ongoing government debt. But it seems like at least we're kind of doing the right things and getting back to some sort of normality.
Well, we are, but it's a question of degrees. It's sort of like,
yeah, true.
You know, you've been on a 6-week bender of drinking 3 bottles of tequila every day and you've shifted to beer, you know, like, well, okay, it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And they are winding that down.
Better than up into 7 bottles of tequila, which is happening in the States, though, right?
That is true. It is a relative game, but it is, again, you see it on the charts. It's sort of like there are these massive increases in liquidity and then it slowly drips away until the next crisis. And this is, I guess, the problem I always have with it. It's not that the intention isn't good. It's just that you're just forced into making the decisions. It's like it's an emergency. It's a wartime spending. We have to do it. Yes, everyone agrees. But when things are good, we'll tidy this all up. Yeah, okay, let's promise to do that. Yep, absolutely. Pinky promise? Yep, let's do that. And we never do. Like, we just never do.
I was always going to say to their credit, but it's not to their credit other than at least they never promised that. They were never actually responsible enough or thoughtful enough to say we should probably fix this after we finish. Like, no, we're just gonna throw stuff on all over the walls.
Yeah,
mic drop. That was all. It was like, where's the next bit? No, there's no. That's just it.
It's like, there's this great. It's probably a couple of years old now. There's this great interview with Christine Lagarde from the IMF.
Right.
From the European Central Bank. And the interviewer is pointing to the euros on issue. It's just like, again, it's this vertical line. It's like, so what's going on with that? And she's going, oh, it'll be all right. And it's a really unsatisfying, nervous way. Like,
right, okay.
Can you expand on that? It's like, no, it'll be fine. Will it? I mean, like that, I was kind of just asking a question. Now I'm like,
now
I'm worried. Yeah,
exactly.
It's said by a very, a person in a position of power, very well dressed and educated than that. But it's basically she's saying, trust me, bro. Trust me.
Yeah.
All right. I know it doesn't look good, but we'll fix it up. Okay. When? How? Okay. And this is my issue with these kinds of things. It's just like I find as though it is never squared, right? It's, you talk about government debt before as well. It's like, well, okay, well, we needed that for this. Okay, maybe you're right. When are we going to fix that? Later. Well, we haven't yet. We're not even on the course. Not that the debt is going down. We're not even changing anything that will allow that to sort of go down. So it's sort of, this is like a full circle, probably put a bow on this conversation, but it is whenever we're having this acceleration in this money, it will people who have the money, and you always want to hold hard assets, right? In these kinds of scenarios, because you can't easily create more property in downtown Manhattan. You know, you can't easily create another BHP Billiton or whatever it is. Now, you can, and they can issue more shares, and you can build more property. There are other things. There's one thing I won't mention that you can't create more. But there are other things, you know, but on a relative basis, money will seek that out. And I feel as though you're going to a point where the in a well-functioning market, the calculus is I'm going to make the best bet, risk-adjusted bet, to get the best return.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of like, well, that is still true, but my focus is shifting more towards, whereas I may have demanded a 10% expected annual return over the next 5 years for me to part with my money and invest in asset X, I'm kind of happy if it just paces with inflation, because my goal here is preserving capital. I don't really care if coffees are $20 each in the year 2032, because on a relative basis, my assets will mostly go up. So again, and I think this is exactly the case for a lot of people in Australia holding assets. It's a look at my property; it's done really well. It's a but you do really need to look at that on an inflation adjusted basis, and it's still good, but it's very different. And again, money is what you. The value of money is what you can exchange it for. Right. And you might have more of it, but if you have to exchange a lot more of it to get the things that you actually want, then you need to square that kind of circle, which is why this is all very interesting and intellectual, but it's why it's actually, I have great concerns from a society standpoint, because it's all good and well if you've got assets.
Yeah.
If you don't have assets, so it's always the poor that are screwed. And it's easy for me to say, you know, or someone in finance to sort of say, well, I've got my three investment properties, I've got my super fund, I've got my portfolio of different shares. Yeah, inflation is bad, but look, my assets are going well. And as you said, gold's up, equity's up, property's up. It's kind of like, yeah, I know on a nominal basis versus a real basis there's a dip, but I'm okay. Now you contrast it with the person who's paycheck to paycheck, who don't have, I'm renting, I don't have any assets. It's just like, it's all downside. There's no upside here. And that problem folds on itself and it exacerbates and it gets harder and harder and harder and harder. You get increasing wealth divides. You get a tendency towards populism, which I think we're seeing. It kind of matters for a whole range of things why we need to make sure that we at least try and have adult conversations to steer us back onto a more, which I know you're very big on for this exact reason, right? Like, you know, okay, you guys needed to borrow a bit of money. You needed to spend more than you had. I get it. But can we at least have a conversation about turning this around at some point?
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
I tweeted only this morning, actually, just recording this on Thursday, and the tweet doesn't matter in itself, other than, we've talked about this before, if you care about inequality and fairness, you're going to say, hey, we should do something about it. If you don't, and you're only about self-interest, you still should be saying, we need to do something about this. Because for all of the, I mean, who are the customers for those businesses if they haven't got the money? You talked about social unrest and rise of populism. You want to be very careful about the sort of country you want to live in. You know, you can live in 17th century feudal France if you choose to. And that's kind of okay. And yes, you can say, well, at least I'm richer than that guy and take some degree of relative comfort from that. Or you can say, actually, you know what? I'd rather live in 21st century Australia or wherever you live around the world. You know, we are far, far better off. And I think we want to be a little bit careful about, again, we should do it for the right reasons. But at least do it for the wrong reasons, because those reasons are still real in the sense that, you know, at a self-interest level, having people able to put food on the table, buy your products, not commit crimes, not trying to overthrow your government. And, you know, it's why there's a growing number of people, young people in particular, who are saying, actually, maybe socialism's not so bad. Actually, maybe democracy's not that important. Maybe capitalism's not working. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, I think...
scary,
right? And that's because we know how that can end. Not a prediction, not a doom and gloom at all. But if you think about that and say, well, yeah, we should do all nothing about it because I might want a tax cut this year, or I might want my property to go up another 2%, or my shares to go up another 2% next year. It's like, yeah, okay, but just be careful what you wish for, because you know, at the end of the day, those things. I'm sure people in, you know, choose pre-revolution society, you know, in one of any number of countries, particularly in Europe. When eventually things break, they break, and you know, I don't know. Don't assume that relative wealth protects you, because it's certainly not been the case historically. And Look, again, let's do it because it's the right thing to do. But if you can't come at that, at least come at the do it for your own sake. Someone else gets a benefit because and you are better off at the same time. Hey, that's a pretty good result.
Yeah. I mean, let me just state for the record, it's an absolute pipe dream that any society will be perfectly flat. It won't be.
No.
It just won't be. No. I mean, you don't really want to try
because you end up in red lines in Russia. I mean,
it doesn't work. You'd
like to be able to do it, but it's not going to happen. And if you try too hard to do it, you create Russia or Cuba or whatever else. And, you know,
you want equality of opportunity is my standpoint.
Agreed.
But what I would say is there, that being said, I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests the flatter the society, the more prosperous the society. You look at some of the Nordic countries, Australia back in the day, very egalitarian society. There was always rich people, there was always poor people, but they weren't that far apart.
Yep.
You know, you the richest kid at school versus the poor, there wasn't a massive gap there, right? And it's only getting wider and wider and wider and wider. And just it has really bad outcomes for everyone. So it's sort of... Yep. I mean, look, here's an interesting thing from News in the Week. Did you see this? Of all the jobs created over the last year, 1 in 3 were associated with the NDIS.
I did say that.
So I know you've got comments on that. I'll let you run with that for a little bit.
No, I don't.
No? Okay.
No, I'm happy to, but go on. You said what you're going to say. What's the implication?
Well, again, it's sort of, do we as a society want some kind of framework that will help carers and people with disabilities? I mean, that the kind of society you want? I mean, everyone will have their opinion. I say yes, I do. I do want that.
Yep.
However, do I want my tax dollars supporting someone who's in a difficult situation who happens to have an $8 million investment portfolio? That's a little... Why is this person who has 10 times as much money as me getting government support? You know, it's sort of...
Yeah.
Again, these are all well-intentioned things, but sometimes executed very badly. And it has all these perverse... I pick on the NDIS, but it has these perverse consequences of, again, we're taking money from all of us and distributing it to... a lot of people who really need it, but also a lot of people who don't really need it. Like, you know, whether or not this program existed, you're fine. You're not on the street, or you're not having to not have a wheelchair or rails in the house or something like that. You know what? It is a burden that you have to bear, but you can completely wear that burden and be more comfortable and be in the top 20% of society. You know, there's things like that. And when you go towards these social... I've got to be careful. These terms are so loaded so you've got to be careful. But I often think that when people talk about a lot of these things, it really does come from a good place. And they see the problem and they misdiagnose the problem and they come at it with a solution that's not appropriate. And I think in the year 2024, we can reasonably confidently say that because this experiment has played out dozens and dozens of times in history, and it's just never worked out really well, right? It always ends up breaking at some point, and we're all poorer as a result of it. So I don't know, mate. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that at this point where we stand today, we are continuing to see huge amounts of money flow in. There's a big gap between those who have it and those that don't have it. And as I said, I think the conditions are such that we are not fixing inflation anytime. I've said it for as long as I can remember on this pod. You know, it's not 2-3%, I think, is a long way off at this stage. And wherever that exists, I think people will seek shelter in things like gold, in things like the S&P 500 index, in things like property. And that what you see is these assets go from their utility value of the cash flow they can generate for me as an investor to a store of wealth premium. And like gold, like again, gold, what the heck, Bitcoin, whatever. What is it? Nothing. It doesn't do anything.
Correct.
But there's only so much of it. And I will impart value to it because of its scarcity, because of its relative scarcity to the other thing that I'm measuring it in. You can imagine if I was the Lord of meters and I could just create more meters at will. Now, the distance between your house and my house is not going to change.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to change the measuring stick constantly, it's going to play havoc with our view of the world and how we sort of find our feet on and figure out where things are. And that's essentially is what is happening when we bug our eyes around with the money too much, which I think particularly in the US and particularly in Latin America and places like that, like it never ends well. And there's a spectrum and it's not just a black and white thing, but we're moving in the wrong direction along that spectrum.
Yeah, I think that's right. My quick thoughts on the NDIS stuff and the job stuff. I'm not very popular sometimes, and I'm also stupid enough not to care, and that's just dumb because you know who wants to be unpopular and just ask people to throw rocks at you? But there you go. Unemployment at 3.5% was too low relative to a capitalist system. At some sort of balance, right? When an economy is running hotter than usual, you're going to have lower unemployment than usual, and than average. Like I said, no value judgment, just literally again. Yeah. This podcast is brought to you by maths today. The maths of this thing is that when economic activity runs hot, you create more demand, which creates inflation and creates more jobs. And frankly, the more jobs bit is just you know it's a construct of. You know, it's almost human capital inflation in the sense that those people would have jobs otherwise if there were productive things for them to do. When there's so much money temporarily chasing something, those people get dragged into the labor market, which is great for them. But when the cycle turns, because cycles turn, because that's why they're cycles, you're going to have more people go back out of work. It is no surprise that 8% unemployment and 8% inflation and 40-year unemployment coincide. Mm. 40 low unemployment. It's the maths, right? This is what happens. Mm. Yeah. So when you then say, okay, what drove that? We have the economy itself and we have what we just finished talking about. NDIS is a nice kind of illustration of this. Meaningful increase in government spending that aren't going away because governments are too gutless to do it. Mm-hmm. And what's been the biggest boost in government spending? I don't know specifically, but on the podium, is the NDIS. Mm-hmm. The tens and tens and tens of millions. It's already massively exceeded the original forecasts and is likely to go to something like 3 or 4 times the current size, which ends up being, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 times the original forecast in mm-hmm. terms of cost. And those services are delivered by that. Some are products, some are services. You increase the number of services being provided, you increase the unemployment. The employment in those areas. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it happens. Now, some people will say, "Great, any reduction in unemployment is a good reduction." And I would say, on a human level, that's absolutely true in the short term. The consequences of that, i.e., the inflation we just finished talking about. What is the cost of that excess demand? Well, mm-hmm. What is the cost of those jobs? It is the fact that everybody else, and some people can, Twiggy's okay. If inflation goes up, he's going to be all right. But to your mm-hmm. point, mate, the effective, the group we'll call the working poor, which is again a horribly overused cliche, they're worse off.
Yeah.
Now, you know, is one less person in the unemployment queue worth 100 people paying 10% more for their groceries? That's a conversation we can have as a society. But that is the trade-off. There is no third box where it's like, no, we're going to do both with no consequence. That doesn't exist. I'm glad we're doing the NDIS as a service. I think the structure is abominably terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Designed by investment bankers and neocons.
Poor incentives. Yeah.
To be gamed. It's set up exactly. When you separate the payer and the receiver mm-hmm. of a good or service, mm-hmm. you blow the system up.
There's nothing easier in the world than spending someone else's money.
Correct.
Like, and yeah. It is. I mean, anyone who's had a job somewhere where you've had like a per diem allowance or, do you know what I mean? It's just like,
you spent up to $200 on this. Well, I'll spend $200 on it then. Yeah.
That's what I did. It's like, oh no, it's coming out of your own pocket. 2 minute noodles it is. You know, it's just like you spend it entirely differently when it's someone else's money.
And I'm not even necessarily blaming the recipient of the service here. They're if the government's, it's like tax, right? I don't mind corporates taking tax deductions that I think suck. If mm-hmm. it's a legal tax deduction, of course you're entitled to. Mm-hmm. If the government says to you, you can have this service or this good because you meet these criteria, then your government is literally saying, these are the rules. If you fit within that range, you can have it. So, okay, cool.
Oh, dude, we used all the vouchers in COVID.
Right. No one pays more tax because they think, well, actually, yeah. I'll donate some extra ATO. You're right. You probably won't tax me enough. So I don't blame anyone for this. The problem is the structure.
Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you do it? It's a game theoretical construct here. Right. It's just like, right. Well, you can die on a hill, right, with your morals and the rest, but everyone else is going to do it. It's like, well,
correct.
I'm only losing here. So, yeah.
So I want to be really, 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 really clear. The NDIS as an idea, let me go back a half step. The idea of helping people with disability who need it is fantastic. the structure they have designed, both in terms of the eligibility, as you said, and the incentives of the structure, calling it an insurance scheme, we privatise something that should have been a public good or service. If people with disability need a certain good or service to make their lives better, then there's no reason it shouldn't have been provided as part of the healthcare system. We don't have a national hospital insurance scheme where you say, well, I broke my leg. Okay, you get to have your leg fixed. Here's a blank check. See if you can find someone to fix your leg for you. Okay, well, I've fixed my leg. I've got plaster. They bought me a new car because I need a new car. I've got gold-plated crutches because, hey, why not? I'm allowed to have them under the scheme. And again, I'm not saying the scheme is entirely bad. What I'm saying is it is being bastardized and rorted because it can be. And to your point, mate, this is the lack of fiscal discipline, which has been through multiple governments, started with Gillard, went through Morrison, now with
Albanese. Morrison bought a brand new ute for every tradie in the country, right?
Right. So, there's plenty of reasons, political and otherwise. And again, both sides of Parliament supported the NDIS. The problem was neither of them, either didn't realise or didn't care that if you'd asked an economist, I've said it lots of times, economists are terrible at predictions, they're great at explaining. There are some great economists. I interviewed Cameron Murray, who's a bit of out-of-the-box economist on The Good Oil recently. Talking about housing, of all things. You'll like it, Ram. Have a listen. But also,
I like his books.
He's good. But economists are great at saying, hey, this is what happens in these circumstances. Here's how markets work. Here's how systems work. They're very good at deconstructing them and explaining them. And so Blind Freddy could have said, if you separate the payer and the recipient, you're going to have a blowout. It is, and sometimes rorts, sometimes it's just, as you say, just like, well, I can have it so it would make my life easier. If I had to buy it myself, would I buy those four things? I'd probably buy two of them. The other two would be nice, but not really necessary. If someone says, hey, you've got this condition, you can have these four things. Oh, good, thank you, I'll take them.
Yeah, of course you will.
Entirely reasonably, but that's why the system is broken. Which gets us back, mate, very quickly, to the challenges we have, I was going to say macroeconomically, systemically as a society, where we are spending money we can't afford to spend. At an individual level, at a government level, the fact that unemployment fell and we all cheered is great. Effectively, to whatever extent the NDIS is being rorted, those jobs would not have been created. And so again, kind of careful what we not wish for, but careful what we celebrate. we've celebrated the bastardized results of a terribly designed insurance scheme. That's not sustainable. That's not success. And it's distorting, to your point. Distorting the rest of the market. Now, distortions matter because they take relatively efficient capital or resource allocation and make it inefficient. And when we talk about productivity, when we talk about returns, when we talk about standard of living, when we talk about what we can get for our tax dollars or our own personal dollars, we could have had more things or paid less tax or both if you remove the rorting. And that money would have been spent, as I said, on the more things, or the more money which gets spent somewhere else or increases prosperity somewhere else, creating jobs that, again, are largely being useful, many who aren't. And again, on those inflated, gold-plated, you hear the stories of the $2,000 wheelchairs when the other ones are $600 bucks and that kind of stuff. That's what's going to happen if you let this sort of stuff happen. And the fact governments don't seem to know or care is frankly kind of very dispiriting.
Yeah. I mean, Let's really dumb it down here. If printing new money or throwing money at something fixed problems, well, we could solve every problem right now. Here you go, everyone in the country, $1 million, boom, done. It doesn't work because this is just a little tokenized system that we sort of keep track of everything for. And it's just like, it's not real, right? Like what it needs to do is it needs to be something that we can have faith in and understand that it is a mechanism for information flow. And when you use the perfect word for it, distortions, and it's not even a question of incompetence. I'd say it's almost impossible for any human mind or collection of human minds to design something in the face of such incredible diabolical complexity as the modern world and economy. It can't be done. And so we have this mechanism that transmits money. It's like, it turns out that when it's raining, umbrellas are more expensive. That is the system working beautifully. And so it should, right? Yeah. It should be that way because that's going to make other manufacturers of umbrellas go, prices are up, there's increasing demand here, and they'll put more demand in, they'll add They'll add more supply. That'll correct the problem. That is the capitalist system working beautifully without coordination, the Adam Smith invisible hand. And so when a well-meaning bureaucrat comes in and goes, no, we're going to do it by throwing all this money. Where's the money come from? Well, we're just going to print it. Okay. Now, there is opportunity cost in that. There's dislocation in that. Money that otherwise maybe have invested over here is not being invested. Exactly. Look at all the – you mentioned NFTs before. All that dumb stuff happened at the height of the money printing frenzy. And we saw it in the tech space on the ASX. You know, like all kinds of crazy valuations, all kinds of stupid investments and mergers. And it doesn't change the fundamental base of reality that we're dealing with. But there's a lot more sort of artificial signal in the system, which allows for these kinds of things where you do have people spending, like Jay-Z spending $10 million on a monkey JPEG. Like, it's just, it's pure madness. And again, as I say, look at history and find me an example of wherever throwing money at the problem. No, there is something to be said. I'm not saying we don't allocate resources to where they're doing, but it must have an opportunity cost because we're basically changing the ruler. Yeah, we're changing the system of measurement. So it's, once that penny drops for you, and for me, it's taken a while, but it's just sort of like you just see it everywhere. It's like if think about the good example I think is with war. It used to be very hard for a government to sell a war of conquest to its people because we need you to buy our bonds. Mm-hmm. We need to tax you more because war is super expensive and it doesn't create any value except, defense perhaps, or maybe we get a bit more land if we win. But usually it's a whole bunch of capacity is put into things that only has one real use and it doesn't actually enrich us directly. And usually it's worse than a zero-sum game war. Now you can go to war whenever you want because I can go to war, I can build an aircraft carrier, I can double the size of the military without taxing you more, without having to sell or rely on the private markets to buy my bonds because the Fed will just buy it. Hmm. And that's exactly – so when you look at the US deficit spending, military's way up there. So next time there's some kind of snafu in the world – we don't have to talk about it. There's ones going on right now. Mm-hmm. There is no shortage of capacity to throw all kinds of dollars at this kind of stuff. And okay, fine. I don't want to get into that. It's a very prickly kind of issue. But that has been done with newly minted money. And that is creating all kinds of distortions and that's feeding into it. Wouldn't it be a different situation with George W. saying, okay, we're going to Afghanistan. Yeah, let's go get them. Let's get the terrorists. Okay, cool. Your taxes are all going up 10%. Ooh. all of a sudden, I'm not baying for blood as much. You know what? The reality is there is a cost to these things. Whether we want to measure it or not, there is a real world cost. And when we hide the measurement or when we disguise that cost, it never works out well. It never, ever, ever works out well. Does that make sense in terms of the context?
And I think you're very monetarist in your view. I'll just add the fiscal element, which is the same thing when governments borrow money and pretend they can keep spending on stuff and the national debt is some abstract number that's not mine and not yours, and so we don't feel it. So when the government debt is approaching $1 trillion, which is not created money, it's borrowed money. Now, they borrow it from the RBA, so it gets a bit messy at some point. But
if it's borrowed from the RBA, it's created money.
Yeah, but it's also borrowed elsewhere. That's why I just want to make the point.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
I don't want to say it's not. It's largely not created money. There's some of it might be. But the idea of it's in theory going to be paid back, or at least it's going to be carried on the national credit card by you and me and everyone else listening and everyone else not listening. But you can say, well, hang on, this is the thing with the tax cuts, right? I'm against speaking of being unpopular, was against stage three, continue to be against stage three. It's better, but it's not good because it increases the government debt. And people say, well, hang on, I want my money. And again, it's kind of the game theory thing you talked about before, but it's, I want a tax cut. Okay, fine. But I'm effectively the debit, the credit is to my account. The debit is to my share of the national debt. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to ever pay it personally. So we kind of feel like it's not there. But it has, to your point, it has those implications, it has consequences because the circumstances of higher national debt mean that has to be at some point either repaid or it impacts our ability to borrow in future or it impacts our ability to respond to the next crisis, for example, like COVID. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are better than most countries in the world and people sort of say, but at least we're better than the US. And that's true. Mm-hmm. My usual retort is I'd rather be, you know, being the least sick bloke in the hospital still means you're in hospital, right? I'd rather be outside. Thanks very much.
And we live on the same planet as the U.S. Like,
well, exactly, yeah.
It's a quarter of the global economy. Like, you can, you know, say, well, we're better over here. It's like, yeah, but, you know, whatever they do is going to impact us here.
Yeah. But it's that's why I think we should be dealing with the fiscal challenges as well as the monetary ones.
Hey, mate, I just one thing I want to stress on this too is it's not, I don't think this either of us are coming from the ideological position of debt is bad. Debt's wonderful, right? Correct. Like debt is a really useful enabler.
Yes.
But the idea is that when I borrow money, I am going to use that to create value, and yes. I 1 + 1 = 3 kind of thing. It's like I take some money. But I'm going to start a business. I'm going to create some jobs. I'm going to deliver some value to my customers. I'm going to generate a profit. And that's going to allow me to repay the debt. And in fact, that was a wonderful thing to do, right? That was brilliant. I never would have been able to start this business without that debt. I've got the debt and I've paid it back. The problem is when you borrow money and it doesn't have that positive economics to it. So in other words, I borrowed money. I went and bought an emu farm and I blew it up and now I can't pay back the debt.
Right.
Now for you or I,
asset. Yeah. Yep.
I don't have anything for it. So someone has suffered there and someone should suffer. Not to sound mean, but again, otherwise it blends into a very, very bad place. Government's a little bit different. People say you can't compare government to a household because government can always create its own money. And that's true, but it means that this malinvestment does get hidden. So when you say, we're going to borrow all this money, but it's for a really good cause, be it the NDIS or anything else, like, okay, cool. But if you're not deploying that capital well and it doesn't generate the required return, well, you can't pay back the money. And which means you have to pay back, you have to borrow more money to pay back the other money that you borrowed. And then it spirals out of control. So just to be clear, debt is not necessarily a four-letter word. It is a bad thing when it's not appropriately used. And I think we need to bear all of that in mind.
I think that's true. I don't know if you're a Keynesian anymore, or maybe you never were. I am, so I'll add this in, that the other use for debt is the, and to use the household example, the fridge blows up. You either don't have a fridge or you borrowed for the fridge. You just make a deal with yourself. Same as a mortgage, frankly. You make a deal with yourself to say, I will take that debt on now. Is it creating more value? No, it's replacing value. I don't have to rent, or I can actually keep my food cold. Mm-hmm. But the deal is, I can't afford it in cash now. I'm going to have to reduce my consumption in future to pay back that debt so that overall I'm still better off. Mm-hmm. And my view as a Keynesian at a federal government level is that's okay to do. So if you need to spend some money in the short term for those, a social good or for another reason that doesn't necessarily create value but helps to paper over a hole to get you to the next thing, you then have to also say, okay, but in that context, did it create value? No. Did it create monetary value? No. Was it worthwhile? You can, and let's assume that I'm right. It's worthwhile mm-hmm. because it does mm-hmm. something. It replaces mm-hmm. the fridge. It replaces the car. It lets me have a house to live in. The deal with myself is I'm going to pay that off because that's how you get back to square. So I'm going to say, mm-hmm. right, well, I'm going to cancel a holiday because I'm going to pay off the fridge, or I'm going to not go out, you know, every second night at a restaurant. I'm going to go once a week and I'm going to pay back the whatever it is. Right. That's how it's a shifting in consumption, mm-hmm. which is allowed for by debt. And again, that's equally.
It's a beautiful theory, dude. I love it. But no one ever says, I'm not taking in the government context, point. They say, I will get the fridge and I'll forego the holiday. They go, no, I want the fridge. And yeah, actually, I did promise my constituencies the holidays. I'm going to do that
which
as well.
Is so state, which it's is kind of three. Like. That's exactly what stage three is.
Yep. And this, it's the communism argument, right? It's like communism would work really well if this. Yeah. Like, yeah, but right. But that's never going to be true. And this is my argument against the Keynesians. It's like, I get the theory. Theory makes perfect sense.
Yep.
Show me evidence of when anyone ever pays the piper. So it's sort of like, we need to spend the money now because of whatever. Okay, cool. Oh, are we going to ever fix that? Oh, yeah, we promise. But they never do. So it's kind of like, the theory is sound. I get you. In the same way that the communist theory is sound.
I think you're a little bit... We had a zero net government debt 27 years ago, maybe a little longer than that. It's not that long ago that Keynesian economics was observed by our politicians. We can say, I think there's two.
Yeah, but it only relies on the good great on the people running the show. I mean, correct. That's a difficult bet. Like who's going to be in power in 10 years time, and how smart and responsible are they going to be?
Correct.
And also, just very quickly on that too, there was a little bit of a you know, lucky break in terms of various export booms and stuff. The rest of like, 100%. That saved us. It wasn't like we took our medicine. It was just like, ooh, we won the lottery that week. We got a scratchy and we got it. I was like, oh, okay, we solved everything. It's like, yeah, you got lucky is what happened.
True. But governments believed in that as a policy and a theory.
Yes.
And got towards that, the abandonment of that sense. And I think that's where you and I just differ slightly. Maybe I'm more idealistic. You're more pessimistic, which is unusual for you and I.
Cynical.
But well, there is that. But if done okay, here's my question to you, and we need to move on because we weren't going to talk about monetary policy. We spent 20 minutes talking about it.
20 minutes.
Thank you.
45 maybe.
All right, fine. If you knew that governments were going to be responsible,
mm-hmm.
would you be okay with them pursuing a Keynesian fiscal policy?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So it's not an ideological objection. It's just a reality of I don't trust the people who are doing it, so let's not do it.
It's the same reason why I don't give my 14-year-old $10,000 in cash to walk around. In theory, I could, and he could be very smart with that. But he's not going to be, so I'm not going to do that, right? Like, that money is gone the second I hand it over. No.
I think comparing our governments to 14-year-olds is actually one of the more accurate analogies I've heard recently. Mate, let's move on because I'm just going to push us through.
I wish – can I just say on this? I wish there is – it is so unsatisfying, the dialogue that happens in the media and elsewhere, because I said to you when we were looking through the Fin this morning, it's like, oh, what's happened? What can we talk about? It's just like, I could take any of these articles and what Powell said or did from any point in time and copy and paste. There is no, it's all this peripheral stuff. Insert quote from smart Wall Street guy here, which doesn't really say anything. It sort of says on one hand, but on the other hand, and this and that. It's like, there is no fundamental, no one gets to the base layer and sort of say, yeah, but why? But why? Why is that? You know, like these axiomatic truths that just are taken as gospel. And I find it very unsatisfying that we as a nation and as a country just can't, we are so blind to the, well, not even blind, just not even prepared to discuss or even question the base layer reality of the entire system. It's a bit surprising, right? Anyway, I find it very odd.
I hear you. I got stuck up the government a couple of weeks ago about this supermarkets inquiry, right? The ridiculous dog and pony show of, look over here, we care about your grocery prices, so we're going to do something about this. We're going to hold an inquiry so we can get our 15 seconds of fame yelling at some poor, well, I should say poor, they're fine, some supermarket CEO who's got to sit in front of a Senate committee and get yelled at by people so that, you know, the politicians can pretend they're doing something about something and they actually care. I had a pretty big go about that. I don't know if I mentioned, did I mention the pharmacy stuff on the pod? I probably did.
Yeah, I think we touched on it.
At the same time, the government, with the opposition's complete silence, has ushered through another massively anti-competitive five-year deal where pharmacists get protected from competition both in their local area and from anyone else buying a pharmacy and operating a pharmacy unless they're a licensed pharmacist.
Were we just talking about distortions in the economy?
Anyway, so the police won't say a thing. They are so scared of the pharmacy guild, they won't say a thing. For better or worse, they're not scared of the supermarkets. And so the opposition leader has joined the fray today. It might be yesterday. Anyway, I'm recording this Thursday. Who basically came out and said, we are going to legislate to break up the supermarkets and stop land banking. And that's, you know...
This is the party of small government and free enterprise.
Right. There is mm-hmm. that. So, you know, we're gonna kind of jump in there.
No irony there. But
well, yep, and here was the thing. For all of that, and that's, you know, again, take what you want from the policy. Here's the quote from Peter Dutton. Quote, I think there's a question mark about the appropriateness of that behavior. Ultimately, we've got consumers that are paying through the roof at the moment for items when they turn up to a checkout, end quote. And sometimes they just tell you exactly what they're thinking. This was like, for all of the things that we said we're going to do, maybe possibly at some point in the future, if we're in government, will we be in government at some point? Yes. Will we do this? I don't know. I'm actually pretty skeptical they'll actually end up doing it. But for all of that, it's what do they want us to hear? They want us to hear, I'm sorry you're paying too much for groceries. Look, I'm doing something to see I'm the friend of the punter, not just that other guy that I don't like that you shouldn't like. You should like me more because I care more and I'm going to do more to fix the problem that he's going to do. again, this problem that, again, as you said before, exists absolutely in absolute terms. Prices are up 20% in the last four years. That there is a genuine, issue and implication for household budgets. It just is. But to pretend that the solution is bashing the point of purchase, because that's where it's most obvious, and so therefore, if I tell you I'm doing something about it, you'll think I'm great. And again, I've said many times, I'm an equal opportunity critic. They are both just, it's just this so horrible dumb dog and pony show that is supposed to be, you know, I'm the punter's friend, please vote for me, rather than I actually care about what's going on.
Well, it works. It works.
Right? It does. That's, you know, which is the worst part.
This is exactly the point I just made. It's like everyone listening knows you go to the supermarket and it's a lot more expensive. I put an online order in this morning, actually, and I can tell you we spent $200 for our Woolies and change, and we didn't get a lot of stuff, right? So, yes, everyone gets it. But then it's just like first order thinking. Well, I buy it from here, so it's their fault. Now, it might be their fault.
It must
there
be their
might
fault.
Be a, I don't want to. Yeah. I don't want to, like, you know, there might be a role that is being played there. But again, no one is going beyond the surface to sort of say,
correct.
Well, isn't that interesting that here and around the world, groceries are more expensive, energy is more expensive, housing is more expensive, and rather than have a mature, intelligent discussion about the causes of this and what might be done about it. We jump on the populist train. We point at, you know, immigrants or evil CEOs or, you know, and the populist and there's, I'd like to, I imagine that because they're politicians, they're not that dumb, right? They just know that it works.
Correct.
So again, we've often sort of been exasperated in our industry where we've often said that let's you and I start an investment service, but our marketing is going to be, hey, it's really scary and volatile, and one in every 3 years on average, you're going to lose a lot of value, but it's going to be okay over the long term. Maybe you'll get about 10%. Come and sign up to our services. These people over here are promising like insane returns with hardly any risk. And it's the same here. It's like, so you can, the politician that gets up and goes, well, actually there's really some deep seated fundamental factors that are at play here. And it's very complicated, and it's going to require you to think a lot, and it's going to require you to get your head around some very advanced topics. Or I'm just going to say that Woolies are evil. I'm going to go with that. And it's the immigrants. Let's go with that. Yep. And it's just, it's so depressing that it's so effective.
That's what it is. I sometimes admire, sometimes despair for people who on Twitter say, I can't believe Albo's so stupid. I can't believe Peter Dutton's so stupid. It's kind of like that's giving them more credit than they deserve, because this is not, they don't know. Is they know and they don't care. And that's both incredibly dispiriting and depressing, but it's, you know, that there's no lack of, maybe it's not the supermarkets. Let's actually try and find out.
Well, that's why the fourth estate is so valuable. And this is the other great despair of our times, I think, is just the erosion of quality journalism. And that is the institution that is meant to actually, rather than get up at the press club and try and get, you know, a politician to quote the latest figure as a gotcha. It's like, why don't you ask a normal question? Like what people want to know, get to the root cause of it. Like, you guys get to frame the discussion here. Right.
Except we're kind of too worried about clickbait.
You made the point that
we don't care. We're happy with the supermarket acquirer because we think the supermarkets are bad guys. It's both, right? Like the we don't want to know. We actually don't want to know. We want to blame the supermarkets because it's easy, so we can go back to do what we're doing. And you're right. I don't disagree with you. I think the problem is we have a three-legged stool. The things that we expect, that we genuinely want, right? We as an entire populace, not you and me, not our listeners, everybody as a group, right? What do we actually want? What do we actually want to engage with? Do we actually want the hard questions answered on the news or in the newspapers? We've got the media who aren't asking the right questions, partly because there's not enough of them, partly because the business model have changed, partly because it's just easy to do the clickbait headline. And the politicians, I've said before, mate, I strongly believe the worst part of Trump's ascendancy, regardless of your politics or whatever, is when he just would do and say things and refuse to back down. In the old days, Nixon resigned over something that Trump, you know, has done worse
it's
than
just a Tuesday.
Right? Well, that's the thing. And so you kind of go, hang on. At one point, the pollies themselves had a standard of behavior they all expected of each other and themselves. And so you kind of say, well, hang on, there's fewer media voices. there's fewer investigative journalists. God bless Kate McClymont for the Sydney Morning Herald, who is just a rock star in that space. There's others around as well. So that, yeah, there's fewer investigative journalists. There's fewer serious stories. There's politicians who don't know and don't want to know and don't care and are happy just to bluster. And, you know, we had a prime minister with five ministries at one point not too long ago. And a public who say, I just want to believe. If I tweet about Woolies and Coles, I get accused of, why would you stand up for the big guys? And of course they're doing it. And someone told me this morning, well, cabbage has gone from $3 to $10, therefore there's price gouging. And it's just like that single anecdote of, I don't know, mate, you're not wrong in any of those things. The problem is I think it's all of them. And I don't know how you, maybe I want to believe this is true. I think if I was going to put a finger on something, I reckon it's that political standard. The things they simply would not have accepted of each other. That, you know, the standards of what we call civil society, which is kind of a bit of an elitist, kind of ridiculous term, but the idea of, like, Polly's wouldn't, you know, Barry O'Farrell, the New South Wales Premier, resigned over a bottle of Grange. Right? It's, you know, Ros Kelly and the whiteboard, you know, the Hawke government, you know, there was ministerial accountability, early Howard government, same thing. I think, well,
So that's what Trump showed the world.
Right.
Is that actually, you can say whatever you want and there's no content. Yeah, like, that's right. Okay. And it comes back to our discussion, the fiscal discussion we're having before. Is that I think there was a responsibility there because politicians assumed that no one would, if we start doing, no one's going to stand for that. Yeah, no. They will storm the Capitol and hang us from the rafters if we do this. So we didn't do it.
We won't do it,
And then really in the last couple decades, we've figured out that actually you can. Turns out you can. You can say whatever you want and you can spend whatever you want and no one cares. And I think once that clicks, it's kind of like, oh, it's on. Oh, I can do this? Yep, I can. Yeah. No one's going to question it. Well, no, seriously. And they're going to point the finger at scapegoats and all these other kinds of things like, well, I'm just going to keep doing it. And then again, game theory kicks in because you're going, well, I'm not going to do that. Well, every one of your opponents is you're out of the game. Right. So these things were held in check by a very rational assumption that that no one would stand for it.
Yes.
The surprising thing is, oh yeah, we easily spoon feed us whatever nonsense you want. I'll gladly take that. You know? And like, it's just like, really? Yep. Okay.
We want to believe, right? And that can be great and it can be terrible. Mate, on that philosophical note, I think we've probably spent enough of our listeners' time talking about things that are interesting, hopefully, and engaging, and hopefully useful. Should we come back on Sunday, though, and actually answer the questions they want answered?
Yeah. I was going to say, well, we're having the discussion on the fundamental stuff. I don't know if we're actually making progress or headway anywhere of solving any of these problems, but at least it's being talked about, right?
I was going to say, I think yeah, that's, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. I think if there's these conversations being had, and you want to agree on everything. A really, really nice comment from one of our listeners, actually, our live attendees. Who came up to me just at the end, I apologize, I've forgotten your name, but said, you know, it's really obvious you guys like each other and respect each other even when you disagree. And I figure that's, if we're doing some service, that I hope, and again, I'm being arrogant by assuming that that's right and positive, but I hope that that's actually part of what we're doing to you know, help eliminate some of these issues. Even when we disagree or partially agree, having that conversation, throwing those things around, hopefully makes us better and hopefully brings better ideas, new ideas, different perspectives to our listeners.
Oh, it's just, I found it, I've really leaned into this as I've gotten older. I feel as though the best conversations are not with the people who I'm in strong agreement with.
Yes.
So I mentioned to you the other day, I went to a Bitcoin conference, not to talk about that, but it was just like, you know, everyone's on board, right? It was fun. It was a great conference. But the conversations with the naysayers are far better, right? Yes. And it partly because
reasonable naysayers who are equally trying to find the truth.
Well, I might be wrong on a whole bunch of things, right? Correct. So if the podcast was he's right, I'm right, and we both agree.
Exactly.
It's the trouble with it is that you get so convinced in your correctness that you can't see it when you're not. So So I would just really implore anyone, regardless of whatever domain you're operating in. What was that framework called? The five whys or something?
Where
you just
so good.
And that's so good. But I just, this is the superpower that kids have as well. They're just not afraid to go, yeah, but why? Because of this. Yeah, but why is that? Anyone who's a parent, right? You know, you catch, if you're honest, you catch yourself all the time because the little Johnny says something, you go, oh, it's because of this. And then they go, well, explain yourself. And
you, yeah, yeah.
Actually, I can't. Exactly. And you, do you know what I mean? And it sends you, totally. You can just go, oh, well, shrug my shoulders. But yeah, I think what most people do is that you shrug your shoulders and no, it's-
Because I said so.
I signed up to this philosophy and that's it. Correct, you know, correct, you're quiet out of my job. But for those that can go, huh, that is actually, I don't know, but I'll find out or I'll look into it. I'll think about it. I just think that the world is far too complex for you to have any other standpoint. I think that's reasonable or rational. So we might annoy half of our audience every week, but hopefully at least prompts you to think a little bit, even if we're completely wrong, which we very well could be.
And we will try and deal with some of those whys on Sunday after Andrew's finished his ultra marathon and we're back for a mailbag right. episode. Until then. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.